It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Summer here in Wisconsin more and more means watching out for ticks.
These tiny creatures are attracting attention this year for their high numbers, but they're also raising a fuss about the disease that they spread.
Lyme disease used to be thought of as a relatively straightforward thing. See that bullseye, take some antibiotics, boom, feel better.
That might not be the end of the story, though. Increasingly, some doctors and patients are talking about the possibility of post-treatment Lyme disease and also chronic Lyme disease.
If that's not enough, it turns out Lyme disease might not be the only infectious bacteria ticks are carrying.
And we want to hear your thoughts about this. Have you gone through Lyme disease, and has it persisted maybe after you took antibiotics? Or did you get Lyme without ever even noticing that tick or that bullseye? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll talk to two experts in the field. First, a doctor who treats Lyme disease, then an ecologist who looks at the ticks themselves.
And here with us now is Dr. John Smarr, Assistant Director for the Division of Infectious Disease at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Smarr.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And I got to say, too, it's scary because the news, we're talking about West Nile, and now we're talking about Lyme.
Right. There's a lot out there to know. I don't know, the fear factor when we go outside, you study this. Should we be legitimately worried when we walk out our door through the woods that we're going to pick something up?
I think that's one of the challenging central themes about dealing with things like Lyme disease or West Nile or anything that you can get from bugs, because a lot of times, folks, you want to go out, and it's one thing if you, say, have a job where you go outside, you work in the woods. It's a separate thing that if you're recreationally out and about and you hear about these things and you're thinking, well, how seriously concerned should I be in terms of, do I need to make sure I just put on mosquito repellent, for instance, to get rid of the mosquitoes? It turns out there is not quite as easy tick repellent, because if you look at the suggestions and the guidelines to prevent ticks, it's things that people don't necessarily like to do, especially in the summer months. So, for instance, they say if you're going to go out in the woods into a tick-infested area, you're supposed to wear long pants, you're supposed to tuck those into your socks, you're supposed to wear long sleeves, make sure that you put on a repellent on your skin. You can even put repellent on your clothes. And, for instance, I have one patient who lives in a very heavily forested area, and he does a lot of activities out in the woods for his job. And so he just doesn't want to deal with that, and he has actually had that bullseye rash, the Lyme disease classic rash, 12 times.
12 times.
Over at least 2 decades, and he's been treated each time, and he's gone back to being completely fine afterwards. But that's sort of an extreme example, but it's pretty amazing.
I mean, you can see why people are reluctant. You're basically describing a hazmat suit with bug spray on top of it. It doesn't exactly scream summer refreshment.
That's true. It's a very hot and humid hazmat suit, too.
But then you don't do it, you can end up with Lyme's disease. And tell us, what is the treatment now, as we know it, for Lyme disease?
Well, and as you alluded to earlier, it's getting into a little bit of a thorny issue, and especially in terms of when you look at different things online or talk with different people with their experiences, it's important to sort of define what we mean when we talk about Lyme disease. For the main core, Lyme disease, as we know it from the medical standpoint, is caused by a bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi. There are other similar related bacteria as well. It's transmitted by the bite of the Ixodes tick. And in all of its manifestations, in terms of objective things that happen to people that you can actually see, in which people are feeling sick and they can see, for instance, this bullseye rash on their skin and arthritis of the joints, where you can get big, hot, red joints. It can affect the heart, giving abnormal heart rhythms. It can sometimes cause meningitis. I realize that me listing this off is not doing a whole lot for decreasing the fear factor.
Maybe not.
Because this all sounds scary. But these type of things are all things that you can actually see and have been studied. And depending on the criteria, 2 to 4 weeks of antibiotics, of standard oral antibiotics, the classic one that people think about is doxycycline, seem to be adequate in terms of people responding to that and these taking away these sort of signs that they have. The challenge when you bring up terms like post-Lyme treatment syndrome or chronic Lyme disease is it sort of originates from the idea that most people, when they definitely have Lyme disease, they get the antibiotics, they recover, and they're perfectly fine. They go back being perfectly healthy. A small subset of people, after they've been treated, all the stuff that you can see, these abnormalities, these all go away. But a small group of these folks tend to have other symptoms that they feel that are real, but they're not something that, say, you or I can see if you look at them. So fatigue, problems with memory, headaches, other sort of generalized aches and pains. And so the thought is that these people, the symptoms may have been related to the Lyme infection that they had that was treated, but the infection is gone, and then maybe there's a period of recovery that needs to happen afterwards that takes, in some cases, months to maybe well over a year.
So does the medical establishment acknowledge that as something legitimate that's going on within these people's bodies, or are we just sort of seeing this as a cluster of other symptoms that may be completely unrelated?
Well, I think that it's very clear that in a certain group of people who definitely have documented Lyme disease infection that have been treated, they do have these symptoms afterwards. And in terms of the best studies have been done, the most rigorous studies that have been done, there's no evidence to suggest that this is because the infection is still present, that there are still live bacteria that are causing an infection. The challenge with this phrase chronic Lyme disease is that there are some providers and there are some communities who are very passionate and very well-meaning who have come to believe that these symptoms represent a continued infection, and so that you need to have more antibiotics beyond, say, the 2 to 4 weeks in most cases that's generally recommended by the studies. And that's sort of where the crux of the issue is. And like I said, I think that if most people who would sit down and rationally look at all of the evidence available, it seems that the infection is easily taken out with these antibiotics, but that these symptoms afterwards maybe it's hard to say exactly what they are. Something else that also confounds the issue somewhat, and this is true in terms of my own personal experience, is that there are a lot of people who start having symptoms like fatigue, like problems with memory, like headache, and so they're looking for an answer as to why that is, and they somehow come to be labeled with or come to believe that they have chronic Lyme disease, but they may never have had Lyme disease in the first place. And so
I just want to get a caller in on this who might be able to speak to what we're talking about.
Okay.
Carrie in Augusta, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good evening. So I have been diagnosed with Lyme disease 2 years ago. I had the classic bullseye and went through the 1 month treatment with antibiotics. And I really thought it was all done. I mean, we really didn't talk about any of the after things. I heard more from other professionals, from a woman doing a mammogram was telling me about herbal remedies for Lyme disease. I mean, it kept adding on and adding on. But what I found is I've been having some issues with my gallbladder and also with my feet. My feet will hurt at the end of the day, but I don't stand on them. And when I've Googled it, I don't even have to put the word Lyme in. Lyme disease pops right up. And so it's hard to know, is this chronic? Did I really get treated? Is this, you know, what's going on here?
Right. No, and thank you for the call, because this is sort of a typical thing that people can come across. And I my sarcastic comment about Google and its ads is that it's interesting that it's already suggesting Lyme disease at some early point when you're typing in the search. But again, it's within the realm of what has been studied and what we know about how the bacteria behaves, that the type of things that you're describing are not what we are typically seeing when people have a documented infection with the Lyme bacteria. So it's hard to say whether or not there's any connection now that you're 2 years out in terms of, is this something to do with that, or is this something to do with something else? And for me, that's the important thing whenever I see a patient, to sit down and have a in-depth discussion, because the last thing I want is for somebody to come to the conclusion that they might have this thing that they've heard about called chronic Lyme disease, and we miss something else that's important to diagnose and to treat. Because, like I said, as far as we can tell from the good, rigorous studies that have been done, the concept of chronic Lyme disease persisting after treatment in terms of an active infection doesn't seem to exist. And so that means we need to figure out other reasons why someone is feeling ill in that particular setting.
Now, Dr. Smart, we've only got about a minute for your response, but is it possible that people get Lyme disease and then the infection itself goes away, but the disease has somehow triggered a chronic, an autoimmune response in them?
Right, and that's a good point to bring up, because it's a theory that people have postulated as to why this might have happened, in terms of you have the infection, it gets treated, and then you have symptoms, so maybe it's some derangement of the immune system. And that's something that, again, hasn't been completely proven, and at this point it's a good theory, it's something that's worth thinking about, but it's nothing that has been objectively decided, and so certainly that would imply something about treatment, which, as far as we know, giving treatments to modulate the immune system, for instance, after Lyme disease has been treated, doesn't seem to do anything for those symptoms.
Well, Dr. Smart, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. John Smart, Assistant Director for the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore.
Now we'll check headlines, then we'll hear from an ecologist who studies Lyme disease.
And you can join in with your questions. Have you experienced some of what we're talking about with Lyme disease? Maybe something that presents as chronic Lyme disease, whether or not such a thing exists as we were just talking about there. What has been your experience? 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're back talking about Lyme disease, possibly a more complicated disease than we used to think.
And we're taking your calls and your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now we'll hear from an ecologist who studies ticks. They're the carriers of the disease. We have Rick Ostfeld, senior scientist at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies. Rick, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, sometimes I see these hotspot maps that show lots of Lyme disease in the ticks in the Northeast and then a big burning red spot here in Wisconsin. What makes a place a hotspot?
Well, if we knew that answer, then we'd probably be able to go in there and do something about it. It looks like, to some degree, these are historical artifacts, that these are places where the ticks and the important hosts that perpetuate ticks and the Lyme disease spirochete persisted when humans partially or almost completely deforested the landscape in the 17th, 18th centuries. And then the ticks survived in places that were not completely deforested. And it looks like they've been spreading ever since as the landscape reforests as a natural consequence of the way that we have treated the landscape.
Tell us a bit about the bacteria that causes Lyme disease that ticks gift us with.
Well, it's a spirochete bacterium, so it looks like a sort of like a curly French fry, and it's called Borrelia burgdorferi. And the ticks, the black-legged ticks that are responsible for transmitting this bacterium, pick it up by biting wildlife species, especially things like white-footed mice, eastern chipmunks, and to some degree shrews, so these small forest-dwelling mammals. And once a tick gets infected in an early stage blood meal, it's then capable of transmitting that infection to you or me or our pets or to other wildlife when it bites later in life.
And it gets complicated. There are other bacteria that can kind of come along with those ticks, right?
Yes, there are. There are a couple of other species of bacteria that are also transmitted by that same species of tick, the black-legged tick. One is called anaplasma, and that causes a fairly severe disease that does overlap to some degree with Lyme disease. And then there's a fairly newly discovered bacterium that is a close relative of the Lyme bacterium that can also occur in the very same ticks. And it's even possible that a single tick can be transmitting two or even three pathogens from one tick bite. So a human patient can conceivably get sick with multiple diseases from the same tick bite at the same time.
Does that make it harder to diagnose any one of those diseases on its own?
Well, it can make the symptoms of each disease more severe. There are tests that blood tests that look for antibodies in response to these pathogens, and they shouldn't be directly affected by the presence of another pathogen. But certainly patients can get even more sick than they would from each of these pathogens if they are also affected by another one at the same time. And so, and their symptoms might be different as well, so that they don't conform to the classic textbook symptoms of each of those diseases alone.
Of course, one of the big issues, even controversies now, is over the concept of long-term chronic Lyme disease, the idea that you're feeling after effects even after you've gone through the round of antibiotics, or people thinking they have long-term Lyme who have never had a diagnosis to begin with of Lyme disease. What's your take on this?
Well, my take is that this is not finished science by any means. So anyone who tells you that they have great certainty that chronic Lyme either does not exist or chronic Lyme definitely does exist is speaking without the benefit of solved, finished science. I think the evidence is fairly strong that Lyme disease can persist in at least some animal models like mice and monkeys that are used as models for many different human diseases, can persist post-antibiotic treatment.
Does that mean the bacteria are still there, or there are symptoms that are still there even though the live bacteria are gone?
That the live bacteria are still there. That, you know, you can give you can infect a monkey or a mouse with the Lyme disease bacteria. You can treat it with what would be the equivalent of a human dose of antibiotics, oral antibiotics, you know, as the CDC might recommend. And then later on, you can feed a tick on that mouse or that monkey, and that tick will get infected with Lyme disease bacteria, demonstrating that the bacteria have persisted. We don't know that that's the case in humans yet, and so that's why this is not finished science. But there are a lot of mechanisms that have now been brought to light by which the Lyme disease bacterium might be able to persist and evade both the host immune system and the antibiotic treatment, and actually exist in a viable state that can cause some of those symptoms. There's also evidence that some people who were infected with Lyme disease, but who might have had that Lyme disease infection cleared by antibiotic treatment, might have persistent symptoms that do not represent a current infection as well. But that also is unfinished science, and we need quite a bit more work on this.
Well, Peg in Rice Lake has a story. Peg, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I've been crippled for 7 years with what I believe to be chronic Lyme disease, or late-stage Lyme disease, whatever you want to call it. I don't need a diagnosis. It has been diagnosed in the past as Lyme disease. It doesn't show up as active Lyme in blood tests now, but I have all the seven. I had eight symptoms, eight complaints when I first went in, and the doctors at that clinic did not diagnose or even test for Lyme, so I went for 3.5 years, and by that time, I'm sure it was fully settled in, and I was a great candidate for the long-term stuff. I got to another clinic, got an active Lyme diagnosis out of Mayo, and nothing gets rid of it.
Gotcha.
I've been on antibiotics many times. It will get better for a while. When I'm off the antibiotic, it's back.
Gotcha. Peg, thank you for calling. Is that a story we're hearing a lot, Rick?
Well, I certainly hear stories like that a great deal here in the Northeast, and I think, you know, the Upper Midwest has its share of those kinds of stories as well. It's a persistent problem, in part because a strong diagnosis of Lyme disease, especially when it's not in the early acute stage, can be very difficult. And one of the things that's also unfinished science is whether intravenous antibiotics, this very aggressive response to late stage or what some people might call chronic Lyme disease, whether that actually is beneficial. It surprises me how few studies there actually are rigorous studies of the consequences of this intravenous antibiotics over a fairly long period of time. And the studies that I've seen seem to be mixed. It's not a silver bullet. It does not blanket cause people to just resolve their symptoms and suddenly be well. But it may have some benefits to some patients, yet it also has considerable risks. IV antibiotics, it's a really rough go. It can cause all kinds of secondary infections and other problems. So this is something else that we need a lot more research on.
We'll keep an eye on that research. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Rick Ostfeld, senior scientist at the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll talk about what the Bradley Manning verdict means for the future of whistleblowers. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be talking about farm-to-table eating and how to make artisan-style craft food accessible to everybody. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we'll continue our look at a big story happening this week, the sentencing of Bradley Manning, who was charged with leaking classified military information.
We heard the verdict yesterday. Manning was convicted of violating the Espionage Act, but he was acquitted on the big charge, aiding the enemy.
And one question on the table right now. What does this mean for whistleblowers as we go forward?
Joining us now is David Colapinto, General Counsel at the National Whistleblower Center. David, welcome to Central Time.
Right. Good afternoon.
Let's start with your reaction, first of all, to yesterday's verdict.
Well, it's a mixed reaction. Of course, we're a little relieved that the aiding the enemy charge, he was found not guilty on that. But this was a prosecution that has gone way over the top. His conviction on 5 Espionage Act charges he's facing potentially decades of imprisonment for what he has done, and that seems excessive under the circumstances. He pled guilty to the lesser charges that would have resulted up to 20 years imprisonment. And in our view is the case should have ended at that point. What the government has done is overcharged, overreached, and it is not only a threat to other whistleblowers, but also to the First Amendment activities and publishing of the media.
Well, let's look at a would-be whistleblower in the future. They're looking maybe to learn a lesson from what happened, from that verdict. Do you think that people will still step forward knowing what might wait for them?
No, I think that anyone who works within the government is going to be super cautious now about blowing the whistle, even if they do not work in an intelligence agency or in the field of national security. The government is increasingly applying these rules of classified information restrictions to people who work outside of the CIA and NSA in more traditional civil service roles. And so there will be a chilling effect as a result of the Manning case on whistleblowers throughout the government, despite the fact that that Congress enacted reforms to improve or to supposedly make it easier to blow the whistle if you were in the civil service.
Well, was Bradley Manning a special case, though? I mean, he probably knew he was breaking the law. He was releasing things that were clearly classified documents. He'd sworn an oath. Are most whistleblowers in that extreme a situation?
No, but what the government's reaction to the Manning case is what is causing the part of the problem here. In reaction to the Manning case, a memorandum was circulated to all executive agencies to be on the lookout for leakers. And who are they classifying as potential future leakers? Anyone in the agency who has submitted a grievance, anyone who has filed a legitimate lawful whistleblower claim, is put on the list of suspects for the next leak. So that in and of itself has a chilling effect throughout the federal government. And again, it is not limited to the National Security Agency or the CIA or other intelligence agencies. This is what is going on throughout the civil service. So that exists. When you add to that the fact that for anyone who works within the intelligence community, there is no place to go in terms of blowing the whistle. There are not effective, safe channels for bringing information forward, and there are no protections against retaliation that are effective and that have the force of law.
Is there a middle road between handing CDs over to WikiLeaks and not saying anything? I mean, can't a would-be whistleblower go to someone in Congress who has classified clearance? Aren't there other avenues to do this short of a massive media release?
Sure, there are. A massive media dump is not something that I think most people would do. But the problem here is that there are on paper places you can go. It has been tried, and it has people who have gone that route themselves have faced prosecution. For example, in the case of Thomas Drake, who worked at the NSA, he went to the Inspector General, and he ended up having to plead guilty and facing a criminal charge in court for mishandling classified information.
Looking more broadly, what is the value of whistleblowers? What do we as a society get from someone within the government, within a government agency, blowing the whistle?
Whistleblowers are trying to correct wrongdoing that is observed in the workplace. And what they're doing is trying to stop violations of law. They're trying to make our society safer. In the private industry, they're protecting taxpayers by blowing the whistle on fraud against the government, fraud against stockholders. And there have been a number of successes, but when we come into the whistleblowing in the government, the government is in the dark ages with respect to accepting whistleblowers and not wanting to be receptive to their disclosures. How is the government going to correct mistakes or catch wrongdoing if they're not going to listen to people who report it?
You mentioned congressional laws geared toward protecting whistleblowers falling short, it appears. Do you think there's enough sympathy in a place like Congress for whistleblowers to try to do more, to try to guarantee their ability to blow the whistle without prosecution?
Well, it's kind of a paradox. Congress has been effective in passing a lot of laws to expand protections for employees who work in the private sector. When I first started practicing in this area about 25 years ago, there were virtually no protections for people who worked in corporations. And there were some laws in the states, but at the federal level, unless you worked in a specific industry like nuclear power, there were very few whistleblower protections to protect you federally. That has changed enormously through the False Claims Act, which protects contractors. Now there is a new whistleblower provision that provides rewards under Dodd-Frank. They have strengthened protections for people who blow the whistle on securities problems for regulated companies, publicly traded companies. So the field has shifted, and Congress knows how to pass effective whistleblower laws. So what we find ourselves with is a system where there are increasing protections that effectively provide safe channels for people who work in the private sector, and the people who work in the federal government are left behind. And if you work in the intelligence agency, there are no protections whatsoever. So this imbalance is something that is caused by Congress not willing to take on the tough problems within the federal government when it comes to protecting whistleblowers. They're willing to do it when you're dealing with securities fraud or tax fraud or contracting fraud, but when it comes to misconduct and violations of law within the government, they are not so receptive.
We as citizens and as consumers of the media, what are we going to lose as far as information about our government if this really does have a chilling effect on whistleblowers?
Well, if the source sources of information dry up, then the American people are the losers. The American people will not have the right to know about government programs that are wasteful, things that are expensive to the taxpayer, or even illegal conduct like spying on American citizens.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was David Colapinto, General Counsel at the National Whistleblower Center.
Coming up next, it's a look at farm-to-table eating and how to make it accessible and affordable. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Gardens across the country are popping right now with fruits and veggies, and that means cooks and restaurants everywhere are doing their best to figure out how to eat it all.
Odessa Piper has been at the forefront of the farm-to-table movement for years. She calls herself a recovering restaurant chef after 30 years working as chef owner at L'Etoile in Madison. Today, she's a consultant and works to connect farmers, educators, and cooks near Boston.
She's in Madison to give the keynote address at the annual Cheese Society Conference and collaborate on a dinner with Chef Tori Miller at L'Etoile. And Odessa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Glad to be here. Glad to be in Central Time.
It's nice to have you back in Central Time. Mm-hmm. How is it being back in Madison?
Oh, it's just so lovely. I'm just soaking up the summer here, and I can't wait to get at the farmer's market. I told my sister I'm staying with, I'm just going to load your pantry with vegetables. I won't be able to bring everything back to Boston. Coles to Newcastle, you know. We have some good markets out in Boston, too.
Nice. Well, I was going to ask you if you're going to hit up the farmer's market, so
it
sounds like it's too irresistible to stay away from.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, and there's lots of things that actually aren't so perishable. I mean, there's sorghum and hickory nuts, and I'm really excited to see if any ground cherries are being harvested yet. And I heard a rumor that Harmony Valley Farm might be growing chervil root this year, though that won't be coming in probably until October.
Odessa, how important are farmers markets like the one here in Dane County or around the state in connecting consumers with the farm?
Well, you know what's interesting is, of course, our Dane County Farmers Market is the largest in the country, and so it's kind of uniquely spectacular. But it's been very exciting to be out in Boston and actually going into the smaller old neighborhoods of Boston and seeing smaller farmers markets there. And I think that they have a very important role in connecting with, you know, civilians, as we like to call them, just, you know, regular folks, with the kind of access to fresh produce. And I think one of the things that farmers markets are so important for is putting a face behind the food and educating the eater. And so these exchanges are happening even on relatively small farmers markets, like the one in this little neighborhood of Roslindale that I live in Boston.
Well, you're here to give a keynote address at the annual Cheese Society Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with the Cheese Society?
Well, they're some of my favorite people in the world, cheesemakers. I think maybe it's because of the animals that they work with, but they have the greatest sense of humor of any artisan I know. So it's going to be a little bit like going to heaven for me. This is an organization that really has a pretty wide swath of producers, from really large multi-state producers like Organic Valley, to very small artisan producers that, you know, maybe their cheese never even makes it out of a 50-mile radius. And so it's also the food writers, people in media and advertising and packaging. I mean, so it's a lot of aspects of the industry, not just the cheese room. You know, it's also the cheesemongers, the people who ripen the cheese and sell it and retail it. So I like that. You know, it takes a village to make and sell and educate on about a piece of cheese.
And I love one of the things I read about you recently that said that you used to cook with USDA cheese that was sort of more one-size-fits-all, but that now you were one of the first people who said cheeses had a voice. I love the idea of a cheese having a voice.
Well, I have to give credit for that to a friend of mine, Ed Janis, who was, we were chatting about it, but he said that, and I asked him if I could could use that phrase because I do think it is it's a very good way of, you know, cheeses, that expression, goût de terroir, it means the taste of place. It's in French. And so, you know, you have so much of what cheese is communicating is in your mouth, and both, you know, going down, but the praise of it coming back up, there's the voice.
Odessa, I think a lot of people hear about artisan-style food and local and farm-to-table and think, that sounds expensive. I hold in my hand a new chapbook you have out, The Market Kitchen. It's a chapbook of recipes and thrift for the home kitchen. I wanted to key in on the word thrift. Can we eat this way cheap?
Well, this is the beautiful thing about being patient as regards sustainable agriculture kind of coming online in the United States, starting with the Back to the Land movement in the 60s. The infrastructure wasn't there, and so this food tended to be more expensive because we were having to pay for the infrastructure, you know, the trucking and the distribution and just all of these hidden elements that help make the connection. But I think that because we have more and more small local producers sort of infill, so to speak, that the price is actually going down, and it's not that the farmer is making less, it's just that the whole investment is starting to reach a critical mass. So I was just telling a friend the other day, I was just noticing, like even in Madison, you can't go anywhere without encountering, you know, delicious, local, artisanal, well-prepared food at every price level, from the most casual cafe to, you know, fine dining. And this has always been the goal, believe me. And if I could add to that, in Roslindale, which is a very working class neighborhood of Boston where I live, our farmers market is not posh. We've got a huge number of folks there that are using the SNAP program, which is sort of a double dollars program for that the government sponsors for families, lower income families. But there are all sorts of folks at this farmers market at every income level, and that's really a beautiful thing when you see that it's not just stratified with one part of society, that we all love wholesome food, and we all know why it's important.
Well, in this this book that Rob was talking about, you give some recipes for people, and one of them that struck us is a pizza salad. Now, everyone who, you know, works kind of later end, like Rob and I do, you get home and sometimes you're just too tired to cook, and so you reach for the frozen pizza, which is okay, but you have a way to kind of freshen that up.
Exactly. And I kind of liked the shock value of making sure that folks knew that Odessa, the owner of L'Etoile, actually would work with commercial frozen pizzas. I think they're marvelous. I think they're one of the best inventions ever, because I would just pop one in the toaster oven when I'd get home exhausted from a day or an evening of work, a hard day's night, and I would just start slicing and dicing vegetables that I had brought from the farmer's market that day. And while the pizza was baking, you know, I'd grate up some cheese or thinly slice some squash or eggplant on the mandolin and chop up some herbs. And as the pizza was baking, I would just slip it out of the toaster oven, you know, put some toppings on, put it back in, chop up some more, take the pizza out, put some more toppings on until I finally got the cheese, and then put it back in. And because it was, you know, would be cooking as I was adding the toppings, and because I was desperately hungry, it still would, you know, be ready in about 15 minutes, which was about all my appetite, you know, could bear waiting. And so I even realized that, you know, if you're really ravenous, you know, you can burn your mouth on the hot cheese. So I would make a salad and I would take the pizza and snip it with a scissors, just snip kind of crouton-sized pieces right into a really nice, you know, sharp salad of a peppery salad of arugula and whole basil leaves, and toss the pizza croutons through, and it would get a little messy and gooey, but the salad would cool down the pizza to where I could eat it, and I noticed that that all this pizza happiness would coat the greens and make them delicious. And I had some nephews over once and tried it out on them, and they had declared to me that they would never let any kind of green leaf enter their mouth, but they were actually digging after the salad because it was kind of flavored like pizza, and they liked that.
I love this philosophy because if I get some fancy ingredient, I feel like a lot of pressure, like I've got to make some elaborate dish with it, and then it just goes bad before I use it. But we can take that funky stuff and put it on a delivery vehicle like frozen pizza and still get a lot out of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think some other recipes in the chapbook, which is it's a very slender volume, I have to say, but it's some favorite recipes. And one of the things I do towards the back of it is tell a story of how I found myself in possession of about 75 gallons of beautiful fresh cider, and I reduced it the way the Amish did to it was a syrup so I could store it. And then I came up with like a bazillion different ways to use this incredibly delicious cider syrup. And so the idea is that we can put things by, and when, or you know, like beautiful, expensive, delicious, fragile summer raspberries or currants or strawberries, you know, rather than let them go bad, pop them in the freezer. Just let them get a mix of peach slices and raspberries and black currants, whatever you want. Mix them up in your little freezer bag, and then in February, bring that bag of fruit out and maybe add it with some apples to make a really yummy fruit crisp.
Well, Odessa, thank you so much for all of the inspiration today. We appreciate having you on.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Odessa Piper is a James Beard Award-winning chef, and she was co-owner of L'Etoile, or owner, I should say, of L'Etoile in Madison for 30 years. She's back in town today.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the first same-sex marriages are taking place this week in Minnesota. We'll hear what's going on with our neighbors to the west.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.